Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Most important thing that I can tell you that by God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous rooms full of people like you and a little bit of effort on my own, I haven't had to take a drink or do no dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'd like to thank Jim and the live group and the committee for inviting my wife and I up here this weekend to participate in the program and be with people that I love and people that understand me and that I understand. It's a privilege to be able to participate in my own recovery. It's a privilege to be able to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. Matter of fact, it's a privilege to be able to do anything. I told Don P. before the meeting, I had the cameras in there. I said, I'm really not that wonderful about the traditions. It's a matter of if anybody out of the past sees my face, they may put a hit on me. And he said, we'll probably be able to make a deal. That shows you how much he's grown. I told him I expected that from him. I just celebrated 13 years of sobriety, 13 years and 16 days ago, something like that. And you know, you go through a birthday period where you kind of reminisce on anything. And I was a year sober, and I was down in Texas, and a guy, he was a little upset about the fact that some business deals we'd done, and I was a year sober. And I really didn't know what to tell him. I was trying to work the steps, and I'm sure I probably, you know, thought of an amend step or something. I certainly didn't want to look at my actions in it. But anyway, I told him, you know, whatever I owed him, I may not be able to pay him. And he said something about that, something to the effect that he'd kill me if it took a dozen years. So 12 years later, when I was standing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, on Wednesday night, I go to the Pacific Group, and I was telling a friend of mine who's a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I respect, and who, he's a spiritual giant, you know, and all those things. I said, you know, in a few minutes, that guy will have been proven wrong, because he said he'd kill me if it took a dozen years. And my friend said, well, Keith, I hate to tell you this. You never know. You just never know, only in Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, I'm glad to be an alcoholic. I'm glad to be something, for Christ's sake. You know, I never knew what I was. I'm a real alcoholic, too, by the way, in case you wonder what one looks like. I know I really don't look like a real alcoholic, but I didn't look like this when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But by the definition in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a real alcoholic. By that definition, it describes, in the chapter There Is a Solution, I think, it talks about the very fact that there's moderate drinkers, heavy drinkers, and real alcoholics. And if there's anything that I totally identify with, is that particular part in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous where it describes a real alcoholic. And it says, by no means is this a general case, but it's the description of the alcoholic that they choose to use. And in that description, it says that the real alcoholic is someone who's insanely drunk most of the time, a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, someone who has certain abilities but always tends to cause terror and bewilderment and various freaky things at the most inappropriate time. And I identified with that. And it also goes on to say that a real alcoholic will use a little sedative to calm their nerves. And when that doesn't work, well, they'll use a little morphine, usually find a doctor to get a little morphine to enhance their drinking and their thinking, which strongly implies that a real alcoholic will use a little dope, too, heaven forbid. You know, I mean, But I'm a real alcoholic by that definition, and I'm grateful for that. I'm glad to find out what I was. You know, I don't identify with anybody that specialized. If you specialize, that's fine. I'm a pig myself. I'd do anything, anytime, anywhere if I thought I'd get a fix off of it. I'd stick a horse turd in my right ear if I thought I'd get a fix off of it. Some of the people I ran around with said I did that, too. And when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard a guy say, and he identified exactly what he described the way he did. He said, I used to drink a little beer, and then maybe I ought to do something. Then I'd smoke a little weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And then I'd shoot a little speed so I had the strength to do it, you know, and then I'd do a little coke so I could be cool, you know. And I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do, you know. I understand doing a geographic in place. I'm an old speed freak. That's like going 190 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor, you know? I'm not a whole lot different than that today. I mean, in sobriety, my drug of choice is adrenaline, for Christ's sake. I get it on. You know, I've always been that way. And, you know, there's certain things that happen to you if you got that type of personality. Drinking was a contact sport for me. I ran into a lot of things. I attracted to a certain type of a personality. You could line 10 women over there against that wall, and I'd get the sickest one every time because I... The one I'm married to today, you know, Christ, she goes to 4 or 5 Al-Anon meetings a week and one speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a week just to be able to, you know, love and tolerate and grow spiritually along with me. I mean, I'm her claim to fame, after all, for Christ's sake. But that isn't why I love her. The reason I love her, last weekend she took 60 young people, AAs and Al-Anons, to Magic Mountain. She rode all the rides all day long with them. They were there at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they left at midnight. The last ride, as they flipped the lights, they were on it, you know. And, you know, just crazy all the time, just ready. I mean, that's the way I am. That's the way I was before, and that's the way I am today. That's why I like sobriety. If you want to sit around in a shell and be a poop butt, that's fine, man. I mean, I'll just... maybe shake your hand on my way by, because I guarantee I'd love it. I love life. I love the enthusiasm about life. I'm there, man. I'm ready to do it. Whatever, you know. A lot of the things that I do in sobriety is exactly the same way that I stayed loaded after I survived on the street. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I certainly wasn't a victim. It's probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me, because I grew up in an environment where there were neurotic, selfish, self-centered, egotistical, crazy people. And if you live in that environment and survive, you have to be a survivor, man. I mean, you've got to be able to look out for your own burns. And at 34 years old, I came to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober ever since. And I stay sober with people who are selfish, self-centered, neurotic, egotistical, crazy, insane people. And in order to stay sober, you've got to be a survivor, man. You know, it's the best deal I ever had. I want to thank my dad, you know. So I enjoy that part of life today. It amazes me. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I just, you know, I'm amazed that I'm just able to enjoy life and participate in it. I mean, I certainly not painting any picture that life is not without a little pain, but I've done enough inventory work to understand that I'm not a masochist, I'm a sadist. I'm glad for the first step for that, certainly pointed that out. I wasn't sure there for a while I could vacillate back and forth. You know, that's kind of insane there when you're trying to figure out whether you're the BD or the beat-or. I really didn't have to do that much inventory work. I just looked at the people I sponsor. They'll tell you something about you, I'll guarantee you. But I was born in Texas, and that doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. It gave me certain characteristics, I think. It's part of my ethnic background that I've always been able to recognize your character defects, and I've always had a real need to tell you about them. And I grew up, in a pretty bizarre environment. I wouldn't say that it was an unhappy home. It was rather exciting. And I functioned in that environment. I drank at an early age, and I don't know if I was an alcoholic when I was born. It really doesn't make any difference to me. I'm certain that when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. That I'm certain about, because it just bloomed from there on. It just went, it cycled, you know. And I hear a lot of alcoholics. I'm not sure, you know. I mean, maybe it's just where I am today. That's all I can really share with you is where I am today. But for some period of time, I've listened to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they seem to want to, you know, they kind of parrot, you know, alcoholics talk in ideals and live in reality. And I don't know if you noticed that or not, but if you stay around here long enough, it'll hit you right between the eyes eventually. And I notice, you know, people say, well, I felt different, so I drank, you know, one of those kind of things. And I felt weird, so I drank. I felt like I was an alien, you know, from outer space on a planet where, you know, I felt like I was born in the wrong family. All those little phrases I never really felt that way. I'm sure that I was that way because I identify with the feelings, but when you're an egotist, I mean, there's people who wait for things to happen, there's people who watch things happen, and then there's people who make things happen. They're about 1% of the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, in case you're wondering who they are. They're the ones that do all the work, usually, but they're egotistical people. Most of the speakers are that way. Very few of us are humble, you know. And we're always lonely about midnight on Saturday. There's nobody any lonelier than the banquet speaker at midnight, you know. You know, where are all those people that said they loved me and I was wonderful, you know? But egotists, you know, I you'll get your turn. You don't always just get to stand in front of the mirror and practice your pitch. You know? But I had to recognize that. I mean, I always was just out front doing things. The problem was that occasionally I'd look around and nobody was following me anymore. You know, I mean, and so I'd have to go gather up another bunch. And some of my frustrations have always been the simple fact that I really didn't want to fit in, for Christ's sake. I just wanted to get you in step. You're all out of step. Don't you understand? I mean, if you'll just go along with the drill, we'll all be all right. And that's very frustrating, you know. Probably from some of that kind of frustration, why I developed a lot of anger. I'm a violent drunk, physically violent. There's a lot of awareness is about that I've come to know over the period of years. I didn't set out to be that way. I've come to see that anger is my cross to bear. I thought many times I'd much rather have lust, but I just didn't get the choice. Anger is just it. And I've had to take that anger and turn it into positive energy. I mean, I've had to use that as energy to do things to stay sober. But I didn't know that. It's motivated from fear for me. I was a scared little boy that grew up to be a scared little boy, that's all. And I learned at a very early age that to don't fight fair, baby. I mean, I never wanted to fight fair. I mean, I don't know where that comes. The fair's in Pomona around our area. I mean, I don't know. I didn't fight. I'd start a fight, and then I'd leave, and then I'd wait outside the bar for 2 hours to hit you upside the head with a 2x4. But I won, I'll guarantee you. And I learned about equalizers at an early age, all those kind of things. It just came natural. And I drank for the effect. I drank just exactly the way it describes it in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's men and women drink for the effect. And the effect is after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That's also the definition of a sociopath, a psychopath, but someone who doesn't have a conscience. And one of my biggest fears in sobriety was that maybe I wasn't going to ever have a conscience. But unfortunately, through strong sponsorship, I've developed a conscience. They have a way about that. I had those feelings, emotions, and energy. I mean, I drank alcohol till I became, you know, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization in my life. I drank until I got to that point. And then I bought myself a Harley Davidson and a bag of dope and became a legend in my own mind. I mean, I just moved into another plateau. I never, you know, and then I just hit a brick wall and I had no other place to go. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It just kind of gets that way. I didn't come here because I wanted to eat a red jelly donut and drink a cup of coffee. I came here because it was the last house on the block. I came here because all my enablers were gone. I came here because I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. I came here because nobody would roll over when I snapped my fingers anymore. And all those reasons that most of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous in our own way, in our own, you know, feelings. I don't ever remember setting out to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever remember writing a goal list. I just did things and went around. And I went around and around and up and down. I have not missed anything, man. I'll guarantee you, I believe that if my God gives me an opportunity about 2 minutes before I take my last breath, just before I die, and he says, would you like to have a replay of your life? And I'm going to say, yeah, let her go. It's going to be on extended play, baby. It's going to be a long one. And that's the way it is. For all my life, it's been that way. And I'm a runner. I love to run, man. I mean, split when everything else is the last option. So I've traveled a lot, I've geographicked a lot, and all those kind of characteristics were there from the very beginning of my time. And By the time I was 17, 18 years old, I'd been in a lot of trouble. I seemed to attract a lot of trouble. I had spent quite a bit of time locked up. People seemed to want to observe my behavioral patterns. I don't really know why. I mean, and they always ask the stupidest questions, you know, why did you do that? I don't know why. You know, you learn to eventually give them some kind of an answer. It drives them crazy, and then eventually, you know, they react a certain way, and then it becomes boring to give them those answers, so then you just don't tell them anything, and that really drives them crazy. It just makes the little vein in their forehead pulsate, you know. And I had a lot of those kind of problems. By the time I was 17, 18 years old, by the time I was 18 years old, I'd been married and divorced. I had been locked up for a period of 3 or 4 years, I think, incarcerated in some kind of an institution, and I really didn't know why. It just usually was what was the next indicated thing. I just did it, and I developed a certain set of patterns and habits, I'm sure, as a result of that environment that I carried into my life. And I never really, I grew up in a Baptist Bible Belt in there where, you know, all the sins were preached, and, you know, I'd been baptized and sprayed and dunked and screwed, blued, and tattooed, you know, by the time I was, and it didn't take. And by the time I was 18, 19 years old, I knew that every family had to have a black sheep, and I was just theirs, man. I mean, that was just it. You know, you're a bad example. I never set out to, you know, they said, if you don't do this, you're going to go to hell. I mean, I knew I was gone, man. I mean, that's where all my friends were by the time I was 18 years old. You know, I mean, it was just, I had that kind of an attitude. I had a rotten attitude, and I had an idea about life that all the world was sheep, and I had the shears. And that's a frustrating way to be. I mean, it really is. It's a real dilemma. And so I'd get drunk and loaded and go on about doing whatever it was that I was doing. And I one Saturday night, I wasn't doing anything. When I'm not doing anything, something usually happens. I mean, it's just, that's the way it is. And I was standing around a little country dance on Saturday night, and at midnight, the band took an intermission. And everybody that had anything going for them was doing something. I watched them, man. I'm there going out, you know, they're either going to fiddle, whittle, or diddle, you know. I don't know what they're going to do, man. I don't have nothing going for me. I don't have a driver's license. I had a bummer ride. I don't have any money. I don't have any place to stay. I just got out of jail. And so I started to fight. I mean, that's just a logical thing to do. I mean, let's let it happen. And I don't stay around until fights are over, because that's how you get your butt kicked. So I punched a guy that seemed to need to want to be punched, and I just obliged him. And I took off for the woman's restroom, and because that's where I was hiding. And there was this lady standing by the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And she said, okay. And I run in the woman's restroom, jumped on the stool, locked the door, and waited. And pretty soon she stuck her head in it and said, you can come out now, cowboy. And I thought, okay. And I went out, and the band was playing. Everybody was back dancing again. And so I asked her to dance. I mean, she's just standing there, you know. And I'm a quick study. It don't take me long to find out the things I need to know. I found out in one quick dance she had a job, a car, a driver's license, a place to stay, and I fell in love. Met all the requirements, you know. I mean, of course, you understand I was never, ever going to fall in love again, you know, because I'd just gone through a painful experience. But I needed help. I needed a mother, a nurse, a bondsman, you know. I needed a driver, I needed a banker, and she met all the needs. And in a short period of time, I found out that she was, you know, we kind of sick attract sick, and it was just kind of, she just got out of an unwed mother's home, you know, and she was telling me, and I said, we deserve each other. I mean, that's just kind of an ooh, sick, sick, sick thing, you know. You know, we didn't fall in love with each other. We fell in sick with each other is what we did. You know, that's why the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers, you know. And we just kind of took up a little light housekeeping for a period of time. And I kept getting in trouble and having the need for help. And she, you know, had a need to help somebody. You know, I didn't realize that that was pre-Al-Anon thinking, but it didn't make any difference to me. I was just doing the next indicated thing. So I, you know, I went about doing the things. I kept getting in trouble and you know. One day she told me she was pregnant, and I was the father. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about crossing over an invisible line. I don't remember that. If it happened to me, I was loaded when it happened. And I didn't remember whenever she got pregnant either. But I took credit for it, because it's about the only claim to fame I had going for me there. You know how we are? You know, we just adjust. So, well, I think I'll be a husband and a father. I don't know anything about that. You know, I mean, I don't know anything about responsibility. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said responsibility is very simply the ability to respond. I didn't know that. I mean, I found myself with a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat and a house and a job and all these things, and I'm a thief. You know, I know I'm a thief. God knows I'm a thief. Now you know I'm a thief. I'm a thief. I don't like to work. It's boring. You don't make enough money. I mean, you have to put up with people's crap. It's not exciting. I mean, it's just, I could think of a thousand reasons why I don't like to work. And yet all the people that seemed to be around me wanted me to work. They said, you got to work. You got to get up and go to work. You got to do these things. You got to get an education. And you got to, all these kind of responsible things. And I think most alcoholics at any given time, given the right opportunities, will try to shape up and fly right. You said, I don't know how. I mean, my that page in my book is gone, you know? I mean, I just, and I kept getting in more trouble. And eventually I had to leave Texas. That'll happen to you. You stay around certain places, well, eventually you have to leave. And we talk about those things here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we refer to them as geographics. But in Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. I was had a few burlap bags full of some non-habit-forming marijuana, and I had a felony hit and run, and it became necessary for me to leave town, and so I sweet-talked my lady and this little girl, and we loaded up all our stuff, and we split. We went to California. We went to California because everybody said, you shouldn't go to California. That's why I went to California. I mean, it made sense to me. A guy offered me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, and I didn't have sense enough to know that was ocean, man. I mean, took me 30 days to make the trip. You know, I mean, that's a story in itself, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, it just, most people can make that trip in three. You know, it was just insane by the time we got there, and I got arrested just as soon as I got there. I mean, there's something about that. I left Texas to keep from getting arrested. I got arrested just as soon as I got there, because everywhere I went, I took me, and I'm the first one to get there. And it just seemed like they're looking for me, and they arrest me for all the stupid reasons. I came right across the California line. I had a station wagon loaded down with all this stuff, with a trailer on the back with all my prized and worldly possessions. I had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog and a cat that both hated each other and me and everybody else in that station wagon. Had a kid that was bawling and screaming all the time, and somewhere in the journey I'd taken the mirror off the right side of the car. Don't know what had happened. I didn't need it anymore, because she was sitting over there and her job was to roll the window down and look out there and tell me if I could get over there. We improvised. And the California Highway Patrol said, we don't have a human rearview mirrors in California. I said, what the hell is she for then, other than another Social Security number, you know? Jesus. And, you know, I mean, I didn't understand it. I mean, I promised them we're going to go out there and have a new start, you know, except I forgot where the start button was. I don't know. I just, you know, I attract negative stuff and sick people and crazy people just like flypaper. I left Texas to get away from them, you know, them or the banditos and everybody that's crazy and having a good time and going to jail and prison. And I went to California. I moved right in next door to them. I mean, just, bam. I don't even know how I found the place. I called a drunken uncle of mine who was in the real estate business. He said, man, I've got a house for you. Hell of a deal. Nobody's lived in it for 2 years. Waiting on you. You know? I mean, a motorcycle gang lived right next door to me. A bunch of AWOL Marines were over there. They ran away from El Toro. They didn't like discipline and authority either. And they were taking LSD, laying in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down, man. I never seen nothing like that in Texas, I guarantee you. Weird, weird people. It made them blind, even. And, I moved right in there, felt right at home, you know, just crazy people, you know. Got the old cars in the front yard, everything, just zoom, there you are, just adjusted. And then they wanted me to work again. I mean, that word kept coming up all the time, you got to go to work. When I worked, I kind of worked in the oil fields. I like to work in the oil field because every rig's got a pusher and the joints are about 20 foot long, and dope comes in 5 gallon buckets, you know. I mean, if you don't understand that, you don't understand oil field talk. Well, that's all right. I've never had a pap smear either. But I mean, you know, I'll tell you what it was. I mean, I hung around people and they said, if you get in jail, we'll get you out. If we can't get you out, hell, we'll get in there with you. You know, that's it. And they did it too, you know. And I'd take off and go work. You know, I left Texas. I worked in oil fields in Texas when I worked. And I left Texas. I come to California, go to work in oil fields, and go to Louisiana to work. Made sense to me. When you can't work in Louisiana anymore, you go back to California where your house and your family is, and you rest up. Then you go to Alaska and work. Made sense to me. The only reason I come home is to rest. And this woman kept getting crazier and crazier and crazier all the time. I mean, I'd come home and I'd have all my friends with me, you know. They're the guys that don't want to go home to their old lady. I don't know their name, but they're right there behind you. So when you go up there and you kick the door down, I had one of them doors that was hollow, you know, had the press board in it. So you kick her down once, you don't have, no problem, just put cardboard back up there. You go up and kick it down and there she is, like her mouth attached to the other side of that door, man. Just, yeah! And just screaming and yelling all the time, and the kids running around there, and the dogs barking, and the cats running back and forth, you know, and your friends are back there behind you, and she's got the butcher knife waving around in this, and your friends are saying, hit her, you know what I mean? You hit her, for Christ's sake. She's going to kill me. I mean, I was having trouble defending myself. She put these pots and pans inside the door, you know, and I wore cowboy boots, and I kept my gun in my boot, and whenever you step in one of them big pans and your boot turns up, it pulls the skin back against your leg, you can't get your gun out of your boot, and you got a pan on your foot, and the crazy woman swishing the knife around over you, and a bunch of weirdos behind you saying, get her, and you can't even get your gun out, and the dog's biting you, and the cat's scratching, and the kid's bawling, you know. I'm just trying to say, daddy's home, for Christ's sake, you know. I come home to rest. You finally get them calmed down. Everybody calm down. Calm down, for Christ's sake, you know. And you go lay down. Everybody's got to lay down for a little while. Get some rest. Crash. I always woke up fast, man. I woke speed freaks wake up fast, you know that? I mean, bam. I'm in gear right away. I got to get something to get my heart started. I don't know where it's at, you know. I mean, I run out in the kitchen, take about 100 mini bennies, throw them in the blender, a little orange juice, couple of raw eggs, fire that up so it's mixing there, you know, and pour a big glass of vodka and hit it a couple of times with some Tabasco so you can call it a Bloody Mary, and you pound that down. You have an intuitive thought almost immediately. You know, I did. And I always thought responsible at that moment. I mean, I thought, well, see, it's 4:30 in the morning, I think I'm mowing my front yard. Got to find the mower first. It's out in the garage, you know, underneath all the motorcycle parts and the good projects, everything else, you know. You go out in your garage trying to find, you got to be careful. A friend of mine, we used to, you know, to keep people out of our garage, keep out of stash, we put a bunch of white rats in the garage. Keep the women out of them. They're afraid of them rats. The problem was, I was afraid I'd go out there and fall down, and the rats would get me, you know. We go out there and try to find the lawnmower, and it's out there. You find your lawnmower. There it is. You know, get your lawnmower and get it out there and get it all primed up. And if you can't find the rope, about 20 minutes after you got that stuff 2 inches behind your belly button, don't make no difference because you can push start your lawnmower. You get in the front yard, get it going. I never had a muffler on my mower because I wanted all them people on the other side of the street, the Christians over there, to know I was doing my civic duty. And I'd had front yard. I had front dirt. I like front dirt. I always grew a lot of dandelions, told people I was going to grow dandelions so I could make some dandelion wine. I never did, but it's fun to mow dandelions because that little stuff floats everywhere, you know. Drives them people, the dichondrelions are insane, man. They just go crazy. I'd be out there flinging and flashing everything around, and one day my mower died. And I don't know, it must have been something I brought from Texas. Kind of a philosophy about things, but don't run, kill it, you know. If you can't steal it, lay down beside it and claim it, you know, that kind of stuff. I blowed a hole in my lawnmower with a 44 mag one morning about 5 o'clock, and I was tripping on that. You got the right combination. Stephanie, you watch the bullet go down, it just hits that lawnmower and blows the bottom out from under it. It's kind of psychic, you know. You kind of plot the burial of your lawnmower. The police come over and wanted to talk to me about my behavioral patterns. They kept coming by there and occasionally running my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times out in the front yard. And one time in particular, while they were out there doing their thing, and the dope fiend neighbors next door were over there yelling at the cops. I always call the cops pigs when they're beating on me. I said, man, don't call the cops pigs when they're beating on me. I don't do that to you. You know? Have a little consideration. Then the wife comes out. She's nuts. She's yelling, screaming, running around out there, you know, and the cops are trying to get her calmed down, and everything's going nuts in the front yard, and all of a sudden she claws or scraps or scratches one of the cops, and then they grab her, you know, and get the handcuffs on her, and I'll say, no, you got the right person, for Christ's sake, you know. She's nuts around here. And then some cop says something rotten dirty about my wife. You don't talk about my wife like that. I talk about my wife like that. You don't talk about my wife like that. Then I have to hit a cop. Then they take the handcuffs off her and put them on me. And then she says, now you got the right one. And then they take me to jail. She comes down, write a hot check, and get me out. Then I run right back home, start all over again. You do that, you know, a few times, and you get depressed. Because what goes up has got to come down. And I'd go home, and I'd get me a gallon of Red Mountain wine. I'd lay down my old rocker. I had an old rocker there in the living room, and kind of kick back and drinking that little Red Mountain wine. They'd line up over on the other side of the room on their line of contempt. And her and the kid and the dog and the cat, you know, look at me with that sorrowful look. And I get the old shotgun out from underneath the chair and stick the barrel in my mouth. Get a sad look on my face and click the trigger. It's empty, of course. You're only going to commit suicide until you get a crowd. One day I jacked this thing back and see something red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. Pull over, click the trigger, that gun went off. That bitch put a shell in that gun. Blew the air conditioner right out of the damn wall. It's bouncing around. The cops come, run my head under the nightstick 5 or 6 times. I can't even hear out of my left ear. Take me down and put that funny I Love Me Not sports coat on, you know, and let you bounce around in a rubber room for a little while and yell and scream with all the animals in there. The psychiatrist come in and ask you, why did you do that? You know, by then, you've been doing it so long that you're tired of telling them the stories, you're tired of explaining it, you know, and you understand if you can just get the insides and the outsides to stop long enough, they'll let you go and you can go back home. Make the great escape again, and I'd get back to the house, you know, and I'd have to plan my escape so I could get the heck out of there and leave town before I got back in jail. I know all the money's in her purse, and the keys to her car is the only thing, it's the only one that runs, and, you know, it's over there behind the couch by the door, and I'd try to, you know, plan and plot and get everything just right, and then I'd make the big dash and run over and grab the purse out from behind the couch, run out, jump the car, get the keys out, start the motor, put her in gear, back up, turn around so you don't hit nobody, and turn back around. There she'd be on the hood. Beating on the wind. I don't know if there's any hood riders in here or not, but I guarantee you that'll sober an old drunk up. You got a crazy woman on the hood, beating on the hood, screaming. Yeah, you got to go back up the driveway, get out, drag her off the hood, have a knockdown, drag out fight. The kids bawling, the dogs running around there barking, and the cops come, and there you go again, you know. That's kind of what it was when I was a social drinker. I know most of you don't identify with that, but I agree with the fact that, you know, I don't know anything about social drinking, and I kind of just said, well, that's the way I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the best I could do, social drinking, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found myself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a direct result of people, places, and things. That'll happen to you. I'd been to see a judge, and he was talking about violating my parole and doing a few other things like that. And my wife had been to see her lawyer again, and he said I was an alcoholic, got to go to AA. I mean, the combination was just right, and everybody said it. And so I said, well, what the heck, I don't know nothing about it, so I guess I'll go. And if you don't know anything about something, you got nothing to fix. So I think I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it turns out they had a meeting that night, and I was laying on the couch and thinking about it. I didn't know much about it, and you know, whatever, you know, I told my wife, they got a meeting over here in church, big AA sign out front. They told me I could find it, no problem. And it starts at 8:30 and it's over at 10. And I said it was supposed to go, you know, and this and that and the other. And I laid down. Along about 8 o'clock, here she come over and stuck that butcher knife right in my face. She said, get up. So where are we going? She said, we're going to that AA meeting, you know. And I said, I don't know if I want it. She jabbed me that butcher knife and I said, get up. Now, I may be sick, but I'm not stupid, man. I mean, I got up and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, pulled up out in front of that church. There was a big AA sign out there. She jabbed me with a knife and she said, what time's that meeting over? I said, 10. She said, I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. I'll stay in that room. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter out here. I'll stay in the room. But I didn't hear nothing. Because I wasn't really an alcoholic. And if you're not really, really an alcoholic, you're not really an alcoholic. And I proved that. And I sat in one meeting a week for 4 months, an amazing thing happened. I sat around one evening prior to going to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked around the house. The old dog's laying next to me. I pat him on the head. The cat's in my lap purring. The kid's over here. Pat the kid on the head. She's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom. Beat the deal down at the courthouse. And I thought to myself, self, I've been too hard on myself. I've prematurely gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know I'll be there someday, but I'll be old, you know? And I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. An amazing thing happened to me. I got struck drunk almost immediately. And I'm going to tell you, there wasn't nothing cute or funny about the next 4 years of my drinking and using. There is nothing cute or funny about that because it never gets better. It always gets worse. And when you've been someplace, you know the answer, and then you don't got it. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there's nothing worse than having a head full of AA, belly full of booze, and arm full of dope. That just drives you crazy. I mean, just all those emotions just going crazy. You really know, and it's validated that you're a loser, man. You're just a loser, and so you have to prove it. And as you slide down the wall of life, you take every living, loving thing that you've ever been important to your life. You just attract all the things you fear the most, and that's exactly what I did. I didn't know that you can attract the things you love the most. I just attracted all the things that I feared the most, and I went all the places I said I'd never go and did all the things I said I'd never do. And yet, you know, my reference points are insane. You know, the alcoholic ego is an unbelievable thing. Absolutely insane. I mean, I know I'm losing it. I know I can't. I don't have control over it. I can't even get the thing to work for 15 seconds anymore, no matter what I put in me. And yet there's something inside of me saying, I'll make it work, because I know what power is. Power is actions. I know what it's like to go around the block and make $100,000, do a deal. I know what it's like to put enough money in front of people that'll sell their soul. I know what it's like to stick a double-barrel shotgun under somebody's chin, raise them up on their toes, and you're taking their billfold out of their back pocket. You watch them piss themselves. That's power. Problem is, I can't get up off the floor to do that anymore. And ain't nobody there saying, hey, dude, tell me about all the big deals, you know? They're not. They ain't asking me those things no more. I'm lip dragging drunk most of the time. That's crawling across the floor, gurgling, you know, to yourself, talking that insane stuff, and there's nobody around, and you know you are just exactly what you think you are, and periodically you get enough of that stuff in you that you're just like a fast car driving. And I found myself one more time standing in front of a judge, and he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy, and he's talking to me about taking another human being's life, and what he's talking about, the fact is I'm a murderer, and he knows it, and he knows I know it, but they ain't going to put the deal on me. They're going to let me take a walk, and yet standing there knowing that inside of me and knowing what kind of a thing there is here that just won't turn off, that won't turn on, it won't turn off, the dilemma, the insanity behind it, there's something screaming out inside of me that says, for God's sake, the wrong man died, you have to stop this thing, for Christ's sake. Can't you understand that? If you know it, stop it, it's your responsibility, for Christ's sake. That's what I wanted to scream out standing in that courtroom. Do it! Turn it off! That ain't the way I acted. I stood right there and I held my mug. And I showed absolutely no emotions, most of all guilt or remorse. Because my bros are standing back there and I got to do it. And I was doing it that way because I had a belly full of reds and that makes you do it. And yet, you know, that's just a small figment of what drove me to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what drove me to Alcoholics Anonymous more than that? Waking up in my own bed, shooting straight up out of my own bed, and I look in the lady laying next to me. She's got two black eyes and her lips are all swollen up, and I look at her and I know I had something to do with that. And I jump out of that bed and run down the hallway where a little 9-year-old girl lives down there in a hole like a cave, like a wild animal, backed into the corner with her chin on her chest and hair in her face, and about all she did was hiss some silly noise when you came around there, just some kind of an animal. She didn't cry anymore. She didn't show any emotions anymore. In the middle of the night, I'd run in there and I'd look at her, and you never knew what you was going to see in there. I seen her. I have one very vivid memory of she's laying in there, and she had her arm and her shoulder in a cast, and it's pulled up in a sling around her neck, and her lips were all swollen. And I was pretty sure I had something to do with that. And I put my head down there in front of her mouth, and I listen because I don't want to disturb her. I know that if I touch her, I know she's going to reek with some kind of horrid, terrible nightmare come up out of there, and I don't want to touch her. It looks like she's getting a little bit of rest, and I put my ear down there, and I listen to see if she's breathing. That's what drove me to Alcoholics Anonymous, fear. Because I'm not a sociopath or a psychopath, I'm an alcoholic.
Alcoholics got a conscience somewhere down there 2 inches behind our belly button. We know the difference between right and wrong. It's just that this thing won't turn off, and it won't turn on anymore. And I don't know what's wrong. Nobody's telling me what's wrong. Nobody's trying to say, well, what you need to do is go to an AA meeting, drink a rotten cup of coffee, and let people love you back to life. Nobody was saying that around me. They weren't talking to me like that. There was nobody around. There's some place you can go and live beyond hate. There's some umbrella you put over people, and if you're not a violent drunk, stick around. Go back out. You'll get to be that. You'll get to be all the things that you thought you never... I'm not just violent, physically violent. I'm not going to debate with anybody whether or not physical violence is worse than verbal abuse. I'll just simply tell you, when I was beating the hell out of you, I was talking to you, too. We don't spare anybody any pain. Don't label yourself inadequate in that area. You give it all. You give it your all when you're there. You see, I knew I had to kill that kid because she loves me, for Christ's sake. She loves me. It's just that simple. And no matter what I did to her, she loves me. And when we were in that last place where there's just a nothing inside of us, that is just, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, anything that loves us has to be snuffed. It has to be destroyed. That's why we beat our families. That's why we hurt people. We hurt them in all the ways. And you know that inside yourself. That's a bottom. You want to know what a bottom is? That pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. That's just a reign of terror inside you that you know that it's just not right, but there's nothing, there's just no way to turn it off. And then you have those little moments when you recognize it and you look and you see it. And there it is. It's not standing in my bathroom looking at me in the mirror and watching the transformation as I get loaded. It's standing in my bathroom. I just got that stuff cooked up and got it in a syringe. And I turn around and I'm looking in the mirror. I'm tying off my arm. And a little 9.5-year-old girl is looking through a hole in the door there that I stuck my foot through. And she's looking through that hole in that door. And she looks at me and I look at her and our eyes catch in that mirror. And she didn't say, Daddy, what are you doing? Please don't beat me and Mommy today. She didn't say, Daddy, will you come and play with me? Or how about let's go to Disneyland? She looked at me and there was a nothing right there in that mirror. And I looked at that, and I looked at that face, and there was a nothing. And I turned back around and I did exactly what I had to do because I had no choice. It comes to that. I didn't have it. It's got me. And when I did what I had to do, when I looked back, that little 9.5-year-old girl's gone. She just wanted to know what direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. Or maybe standing in my kitchen, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm taking a hit off a bottle of hot vodka, and I look down the hallway, a little 10-year-old girl standing down at the end of that hallway, and she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her. She's got her chin on her chest, and her hair's all fluffed up, got an old coat. She slept in these clothes for I don't know how long. She's looking at me down there. She got two brown bags back over there in the corner and a little purse she had with the running money in it all the time, and I'm taking a hit off that jug. And I look at her and she looks at me and I turn back around and take another drink out of that jug because I can't stand what I see and it ain't working. And you know my prayer? God, let it go away. And it goes away. And why it goes away? Because all she wants to know is what direction I'm going so she can go the other way. She doesn't get the hell out of my life. She's running all the time. Yet the alcoholic ego is an unbelievable thing. You stand there with that kind of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You stand there with that kind of attitude. And they're looking at you with that look. I remember one, I don't know what time it was, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm standing, I was sitting in my old pickup truck at a red light, you know, and I stopped in that full end, you know, that half of a half rolled under the seat. There you are, and I grabbed that thing, and I opened it, and I took the hood off that thing, and I'm looking at some guy in a nice new car with a set of threads on, and you know, them lanes that has a job that's working, and he looks at you with that look of contempt. Take another hit off that jug and say, what car are you looking at? I got to have this just to get to the next stoplight. I'm in the gutter, but I'm looking down on here. I'm dying. But I got a reason. You see, I'm dying. And you got to live that way until you can't stand yourself anymore. And I'm the kind of a guy, as long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat, they'll roll over when I snap my fingers. I won't stop. I had to run them all out. An amazing thing, we talk about a spiritual way of life, some kind of a higher power. an egotistical, insane way of life that a person like me was living. And yet, you know, there's something down deep inside that doesn't want to live that way. There's some kind of a little pilot light, I suppose, that's spiritual in nature that was there from the very beginning. When I couldn't stand me any longer, I did the only thing that I know. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because the seed had been planted. Even though I didn't know it, the seed had been planted. And through a series of events and people, I made a phone call, and a little gray-headed man came to my house, and he took me to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to a detox, put me in a detox, and introduced me to some people that were in there. There was 39 of us in that detox when I walked in. Within a matter of hours, 39 of us went in there 13 years ago and 16 days. I'm the only one out of 39 that's still continuously sober. There's 11 of them dead. 7 of those dead sober. The sobriety was so bad that they couldn't stand it. But at the time I walked in there, and there they were, you know, my compadres, you know, I wouldn't have drank with any of them suckers, you know. And I had that attitude. I walk in there, and they took all my clothes off and give me one of them green things that don't have no back in it, and they put you on some kind of a plastic couch and sit down and say, "Are you an alcoholic?" Hell, I don't know what I am, you know. I mean, is your life unmanageable? I don't know. I don't have nothing to manage. You know, I mean, they ask you all kinds of stupid questions when they got your bare butt on a plastic couch. You believe in God? No, I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. The guy went and got a dictionary, had me look it up. I didn't even know what it meant, you know. And he said, "See there, you're running around saying you're something you don't even know what it means." And I didn't know what, you know. I said, "Well, what do we do? We'll go to meetings, and we'll go in here, and we do this, and we work the steps, and the other." Pounding all that stuff. I had so much insanity behind me. I mean, I sober up. I'm just flying apart all the time. I don't know what's happening. And they're just, you know, taking me here and taking me there. And people from Alcoholics Anonymous come in. They're all smiling and giggling. And, you know, I'm radiating hate. And I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm sober. I felt kind of safe in there, that I owed a lot of money when I sobered up. And some people were going to kill me. And I felt kind of safe sitting in that detox. I was pretty certain they weren't going to come in there for fear they might get infected with our thing, you know. You get kind of safe and comfortable in there. And I was sitting around there. A little physical sobriety started coming along, you know. And I didn't know what was going on. And people were talking to me about working the steps, and you got to write an inventory. I said, "Man, my lawyers told me don't ever put that stuff on paper, much less sign it and tell anybody. They'll put you away for the rest of your life, you know." And they were talking to me about doing those stupid things, and I don't know what, you know. They were telling me you got to have a sponsor. I said, "I don't know what a sponsor is." "So don't worry, we'll get them for you. We'll assign you one." You said, "You need a sponsor so an idiot won't be running your life." You know, I mean, they told me things like that. They were not kind to me. I'd spit on them and hiss, you know. I mean, it just, and they brought this crazy guy in there by the name of Rotten Ron. I mean, he was just absolutely insane. I mean, he was sober 9 years and went to meetings all the time. He was just, you know, he was buzzing around all the time. And they said, "This is going to be your sponsor." And I said, "Oh, that's just great." You know, I mean, the guy's just, he's crazy. And so that's why we got him for you. He's just right for you. Yeah. He said, "You need somebody that's more concerned with your life than whether you like him or not." And I said, "I don't like him. I hate him." He said, "That's fine. He hates you, you know." He said, "You're going to get out of here. We're going to let you go pretty soon, and he'll be over to get you." And so he showed up in a van, and he had me and about four other newcomers in the van, and he was delivering us to our little nest. I went back home. I didn't know what to do. He took me back home. He dropped me off. I went up the front door, knocked on the front door. My wife came to the front door, and I said, "I got to go to a meeting about college nonsense every damn day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do, bitch?" You know, I didn't. I mean, she said, "Oh, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kid's been going to Al-Ateen. The dog's been going to Alley Dog. And the cat's been going to Alley Cat. What are you going to do, dummy?" You know, I didn't know what to say. I got to go call my sponsor. I went to call my sponsor, and he said, "Don't do anything. I'll be over there, and I'll get you." And so he come and got me, and we started going to meetings all the time. I just went to meetings all the time. They'd take me in there and set me down, you know, and I'd sit there and radiate hate. People would get up, go get a cup of coffee. They wouldn't come back and sit next to me. I didn't quit carrying the gun. My whole meeting was a men's stag over in Anaheim, California. I mean, it was just insane. There was people in there that did sick, crazy, crazy stuff, you know, and I'd sit in there and judge them. And the one guy was talking about some of the stuff he did. It was the sickest stuff I ever thought. That's bad, man. I'd take my gun out. I'd take a bullet out of my gun, take a pen and 12 pen, write his name on a bullet and hold it up and say, "I'm going to kill you," right after the meeting, you know. Put it back in, put it back in my boot. Somebody else would talk sick stuff. Well, I'd take my gun out and, you know, I'd write his name on a bullet, you know, hold it up, you know. Pretty soon the meeting would be over. They'd all stand up, put their arms around everybody and pray. And I'd think, "Screw them. I'll come back next week and throw a grenade in here and kill them all," you know. I said, "Keep coming back. We love you." You know. My sponsor, I said, talk to me about God. I got to have a God. You got to talk to me about God. And he'd say, I got mine. You'll have to find yours. Someone will kill you. He said, you see that guy standing over there on the corner? And I'd say, yeah. And he said, you want to kill him? And I said, no, I don't even know him. I want to kill you. He said, the fact that you don't want to kill him is spiritual for you. Now, that's something you can go home and stay up all night trying to find in the big book. Why is it that you want to kill your sponsor all the time, but you don't want to kill a complete stranger? Makes you want to get a new sponsor. I cleaned up. You do. You know, you stay around here and stay sober and cleaned up. You got to look good. You know, I mean, you got to be cool. Get terminally cool. I cleaned up a little bit. I wasn't into bathing and shaving and getting my hair cut. And when I sobered up, well, they told me, you know, I should do that. And I trimmed my beard and kind of trimmed my hair. I went down to C&R Clothier and bought me 3 or 4 of them pinstripe suits with the big, you know, reversible hanky and reversible tie and reversible vest and reversible underwear and all that stuff, you know. Went over to this buddy I know how to use car lot and bought me a big Lincoln, big Mark IV Lincoln. You know, all I had was a Harley and no beat-up pickup truck, so I thought, well, he got to shape up. I went and got me a Mark IV Lincoln, big long hood on that baby, and I drove right down to Lano Club, parked right in front of the Lano Club, walked into my fence right street, and walked in there in my corner of hate and contempt and stood there. So just waiting for one of the newcomers to come over and ask me about my car so I could give him a little hope, you know. No, I know that's crazy. I didn't know nothing about nothing. I just stand there. My sponsor made me stand on the opposite side of the room, and he'd point at me and say, I knew what he was saying. One of the other guys told me what he was saying. He was standing over there saying, see him? He'd tell newcomers, if you keep drinking, you're going to be crazy like him. He'll never be any better than that. He's nuts. I knew that's what he was saying. I'd stand over there and give him sign language. One day I stand there and a weirdo walked up next to me. He had hair sticking out everywhere. I mean, this weirdest looking guy I ever saw. He looked like he gave himself a permanent. You know, hair sticking out. He had a funny hat on with strawberries and cherries and all kinds of stuff on it. Had a pair of pants hitting about his knees. Had a pair of thongs on. He painted his feet black so it looked like he had socks on. I recognized that. I'd seen him in a meeting the night before. He was a treasurer in a meeting the night before and they wanted a treasury report and he stood up and said, I stole the money and I ain't paying it back. And they said, you got to keep doing it until you get it right. And here he was standing next to me, and I said, what do you want? And he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, oh, Christ, man. Jeez. You know, I was waiting for a doctor, a lawyer, a parole officer, somebody to come along, you know. I said, I don't know. I have to ask my sponsor. I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that weird over there? And he said, yeah. I said, you just asked me to be your sponsor, for Christ's sake. My sponsor said, the dumbest thing ever. He said, yeah, I know. I sent him over there. Gee. So he's just right for you. You go back and tell him you'll be a sponsor and do exactly what he says. Now, you know, that don't even make sense today. I'm supposed to tell him, I'll be his sponsor, but I got to do what he says. But I didn't know he was my sponsor. I went back on and said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He says, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. You know? I think you go out that door, and I'll go out this door, and we'll meet out the big Lincoln. He said, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed me by the arm, and away we went. We got over by the door, and I had two friends, and they were standing against the wall over there, and boy, we got up right next to them. They said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. Got him in that Lincoln, started going to meetings. He'd talk sick stuff to me, man. That guy was telling me weird sick stuff all the time. And then right in the middle of it, he'd say, you ever do anything like that? And yep, I did some stuff like that. Next thing you know, man, I'm telling some of my sick stuff. And he'd say, man, you're the sickest son of a bitch I know. We need to go to a meeting. We'll go to a meeting. Then I'd tell him, I said, now don't tell nobody I'm your sponsor. He said, I won't. We'd walk right into the meeting. He'd go, this is my sponsor. I said, don't tell people I'm your sponsor, weirdo, man. I'd take him home. He'd get out and go in the house. I'd come back and get him. He'd look like he just stood in. I said, why don't you comb your hair? And he said, I did. Hell, you did. Sick dude. You know, one night after a meeting, we heard a spiritual giant talking. This guy was talking about all this God, and God had come into their life, and the butterflies flew out of his doo-doo hole. I don't know what happened. You know, I mean, we were intellectualizing that. It's a lot easier to sit out in the damn parking lot after you hear a speaker and take his inventory than it is to take your own, you know. And we were out there doing that, and this weirdo, he said, "I want to know about God. I need to start something." He said, I got the Bible, and I read in the Bible it had a burning bush, and they had the parting of the water. He said, "That's a miracle. We need a miracle. We're too crazy. We're never going to make it. We need a miracle." I said, "If I had some lighter fluid, I could torch a hedge. I don't know, you know." Had a 45 in the glove box. I opened her up, took her out, jacked her back, shoved it upside his head real tight, and pushed on. I said, "I'll tell you what, dude, I'm going to count to 10. If this gun don't go off when I count to 10, believe in God." I did. Throw the hammer back, throw it in the glove box. He jumped out of my Lincoln, ran around the car 3 or 4 times out in front of the parking lot, ran in the club where my sponsor was. He showed him that little ring on the side of his head where I stuck that 45 up there, and my sponsor told him. I said, "Ain't it spiritual? You know? Hey, we're both still sober, you know." I moved out of the old neighborhood. Prosperity set in, you know, moving right along in sobriety and getting this guy shaped up a little bit. Got me a nice house, you know, one of them houses where nobody knows I'm an AA. You tell anybody that's got stickers on the car to park down the block. You don't want your new neighbors to know. No newcomer cars in your driveway because they always leak oil. You got to get you a spiritual book or two, and Sunday morning you don't go to church, you read some spiritual books and get into real deep meditation with your God, and you know, what you are, you're about 3 years sober, nutty as a fruitcake, what you are. And come and knock at my front door one Sunday morning. I went over to the front door, and there's that weirdo standing there. Man, his old van's in my driveway, run 6 quarts oil right down my new driveway. He's got stickers all over that thing, you know, and the neighbor's out mowing their yard, and there it is, parked right there. He's standing there with 1 foot, looks like it's stuck in the concrete, and the other half of him's going to Tijuana. He's got a big book with paper stuck in it and all kinds of crazy crap. I said, "Get in here quick before my neighbor see you." "So what do you want?" And he says, "I want to work the steps like you did." And God, I'm trying to think how I work the steps. And I said, "Well, I know one thing. The first step says I'm powerless, and I know I am because it just lets you in my house. You know? It says my life's unmanageable, and I'm pretty sure of that because it looks to me like you're going to be here a while. The second step says we're nuts, and maybe there's help. I don't know. But it don't say how long it's going to take or how much we're going to get restored to us. And I'm sure you're crazy, and I understand you, so we must be on step 3. I said, "That's a cricket baffling." I said, "I'm going to tell you something, dude. I had to get on my knees in front of God and everybody and say that third step prayer together." He got on his knees right there in my kitchen and said, "Get down here." And I'm thinking, oh, man. If my wife sees me on my knees in the kitchen with this weirdo, she's going to think I've whacked out for sure, you know. I got on my knees down there and got the book open, got third step prayer out, and he cuddled up underneath my arm, you know. We said that third step prayer together. The cat walked by and looked weird at us, you know. And he jumped up and says, "I want to do my first step now." And I said, "I got you now, sucker. You got to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house." And he pulled some paper out of his book and threw it on the table. He says, "I can't write." He said, "I'll tell you what, I'll talk you right." And he threw a pencil over there, and he started talking. So I started writing, you know, writing along about an hour and a half. Six shit coming out of that car, man. Terrible. Then he said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did some stuff like that." And he said, "Tell me about it." And I started telling him all my stuff. Matter of fact, a couple of things came up. I forgot to tell my sponsor when I did my fifth step. I knew God was in the room. He couldn't read. I just put some of my shit in his. What the hell? Hey, we burned it, you know. Felt good. First thing, jumped up and ran over there and kissed me on the cheek and said, "I love you." And I thought, well, that's it. Divorce her and follow him, you know. Run out of the front yard Sunday afternoon, way in front of God and everybody, my new neighbor. So I love you, and I knew they knew then, you know, and down the street he went, you know, for Christ's sake. But I knew something that day. I knew that something happened in my life. You see, I was 3.5 years sober, dying inside, because I was just as dry as a fire hazard around here. That'll happen to you. And I knew, you know, the reason I'd had to do my fifth step is because it's got to make full circle, or you don't get it. You see, that's the deal. That's the reason I gave my stuff away, because it qualified me to receive it. You got to receive it. That's where the forgiveness comes from. And the people told me that. I'm grateful for the old timers. The old timers around here that understand those things. They see us dying here. You know, I'm grateful that there's old timers around here that believe 3 years is just as important saving as 3 days. You see, because you sit around here and we let them, a lot of them die because we don't. You think, oh, well, he's been running around here shooting his mouth off. We don't have to let him hit his own wall, man. That ain't what an old timer does. You get over there and you grab him and you tie him down and you tell him this is what you got to do, and you show him how to do it, and you give him commitments and get them going in the right direction. And I'm grateful I had sponsorship like that. And if there's anything that I've tried to be an example in sponsorship, it's the very same way that it was spoon-fed to me. And I stand here today on that foundation.
foundation, and a foundation that was spoon-fed to me by the old-timers, and I have a tremendous amount of gratitude for the old-timers that could see that I was dying. He sent that weirdo over there, and they put him in my life, and I got out of myself. You see, when I sit in there and listen to all his deepest, darkest secrets, I got out of myself. See, for a few period minutes or an hour there where I got out of myself, and I didn't judge him for the things he'd done and where he'd been and those kind of things. Matter of fact, I identified with him, and that's just one drunk talking to another drunk. The spiritual entity there comes in, and I don't judge him, and he don't judge me, and we love each other. We have a common bond, and I knew there's something that happened, and I'd like to tell you every day's been a holiday and every meal's been a banquet from that moment to this, but that would be bullshit. That's what it would be. I have cleaned my language up somewhat. Profanity used to be my native tongue. But it's true. I mean, it's just, for an alcoholic of my type, I don't know about people that come in here and get on the pink cloud and rocket into the, you know, the fourth dimension of stardom, man. I mean, I have gone as fast as I could till I hit a wall and just bled, you know. I mean, I suffer magnificently, too. You get to do that around here, and sponsors have absolutely no mercy on you when you're like that, and they tell you, go get a newcomer and give it away, and they tell you to go home and tell your wife that you love her, and when she's going nuts, they tell you to pray in the morning to not commit adultery and stupid things like that, and they tell you to go make those amends, and they tell you to go tell people that you're wrong. I mean, that just kind of sticks in my mouth right now, you know. I mean, God. I mean, you know, I'd much rather say I'm sorry, you know, or just, you know, kind of, yeah. You know, and they told me, you know, financial amends is when you rip somebody off for $100, you know, the amends ain't made till they have $100 back in their hand. You know, I mean, God, I hate to hear that. I owe $265,000. I didn't know where I was going to get it, and I owed it to people that you don't write them a note and say, I'll send you $100 a month, dude. I mean, they just don't work that way. It don't equate. And I had problems. I used to sit in meetings, and I was just crazy. I had all these weird, crazy newcomers hanging around me, and people would talk about, well, spirituality and the light of the Spirit will shine in on you and wonderful things. And I'd say, man, I got mountains of shit rolling over me, man. I mean, I'm crazy. What do you do? You know, well, here's some old guy went to church, a bleeding deacon, and he said the deacons over the church knew he needed $1,000. And they sent him a check, called him in the back of the church and said, brother, we're going to help you. No, you have, you know, the burden is heavy, and we have a brother here that's got a lot of money, and he wants to give you $1,000 to help you, man. And this guy's running his crap out in an AA meeting, and I stand out and say, when am I going to get my check? I need a big one. Nobody came up and offered to loan me any money, I'll guarantee you. You know, my sponsor said, you got to go make these amends. You got to do it. And I said, well, you know, it's blood money. Can I pay it with blood money? And he said, you can do anything you want to do as long as you want to pay the price. And I know a little more about what he's talking about today, believe me. But you know how they are. Sponsors are smart alecks when it comes. They don't tell you nothing, you know. So you go and tell that guy that you'll try to pay him the money back and do whatever is right. And if he don't kill you, well, you'll probably make it, you know. And I went over there and I told the guy, you know, I said, I can't pay that money back today. And he says, well, I don't think I'll kill you. We'll work something out. And I went back to my sponsor. I said, he said he wasn't going to kill me. How'd you know he was going to do that? My sponsor says, I didn't. You know how they are? I didn't know whether he was going to kill you or not. I didn't figure he'd get off that easy, you know. And I didn't understand all these things, and I just have to stay sober. I got very busy. I'm a product of active sobriety, involved with people doing things, service, and just going all the time. People said, you're going to burn out. Well, I'll tell you what, I ain't burnt out yet, but there's a lot of them that started with me that burnt out, you know. And, you know, I don't understand a lot of those things. It's an amazing thing. I don't know why I'm sober. I mean, I've just done the things that the winners do. That's what my sponsor tells me. The winners are the people that do the things that the losers aren't willing to do. That's just the difference. He tells me you're a winner today simply because you do what you got to do rather than what the hell you want to do. And I don't even know why I did that. You know, I know in the last few days I've been able to reflect back on my life and in 13 years of sobriety why it's not a, you know, it's not a big deal, a big milestone. But it's 13 years, and I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look around, and a lot of the meetings I work with a lot of young people, and the closest, you know, they are is, you know, 5 or 6 years sober. You know, there's a big gap there, and it makes it necessary for me to go to meetings and drive a lot of miles to get to meetings where there's peer group and long-time sobriety and people that stay sober like I do and people that don't criticize you and say when you got a haircut and you shave and put on a coat and a tie that you're a Nazi. you know, or a clone. I mean, I have to be with those kind of people. I don't understand why they ain't what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell me I got to shave, so I'll quit driving my Harley Davidson up people's ass. I don't understand why they say that. I mean, it's an attitude thing. It's a thing. It's a magnet. And I don't understand those kind of things, but I can tell you something that's awareness to me. You know, there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I love, and they're very important to my sobriety. Very important to my sobriety, the old-timers. But I want to tell you real briefly about 13 people that are very important in my sobriety. They're all dead. Bill and Don and Howard. They're the guys, those three guys I sobered up with. They all three said, you don't need a sponsor. She said, you don't have to get that pants and paper. They all three said, there's going to be things I'm going to take to the grave. Bill told me that. He said, there's things inside of me I won't tell another human being. I'll die first. He did. You know how he died? He got drunk drinking Jack Daniel's whiskey, and he went and got him one of them great big old bottles. One of them 5-gallon things with a spigot on it. He laid down when he couldn't get up, and he reached up and he flipped the spigot, and he drowned in Jack Daniel's whiskey. And by God, he had some things he took to the grave with him. He sure did. And old Don told me, he said, you don't need to get a sponsor, for Christ's sake. Go to God. God can be your sponsor. You don't have to have some kind of a dictator to tell you what to do all the time. And what Don did, Don took a 12-gauge shotgun and shoved it in his mouth, and he blew the back of his head off because he was sober and he didn't have any friends. He just couldn't risk that thing. And Howard, I'll tell you about Howard. Howard's one of those guys that's sitting me. You see him all the time. He's sitting in the back for day after day after day. They never say nothing. Sit there. Don't say hi. Don't say bye. They're always there. But they can't communicate. They refuse to communicate. There's something inward inside, and they can't talk. And one day, after a few months of sobriety, Howard went out in his garage, and he started up his car, and he put a hose on a tailpipe, and he ran inside of the car, and he died. He took all of that secret feelings and emotions that he couldn't let. He took that to the grave with him. And I'll tell you about another guy, Little Joe, man. Little Joe was a buddy of mine. He was around AA, you know, and he was, hey, cool, man. I mean, well, loco. He said, AA is about drinking booze, baby. You don't have to quit smoking dope. You can be cool. He died in a Mexican prison. He was murdered in a Mexican prison, trying to bring some of that non-habit-forming stuff over here so he could go to AA meetings and cope. He proved that. He proved about Alcoholics Anonymous and dope. He proved that to me. And I'll tell you about another guy. Bobby Joe, he's one of them tough guys, man. He's one of my bros, you know. He's a tough guy down there in Midland, Texas, and he was sober 4 years, and he's telling me, hey, you can still go in them bars and shoot that pool, man, listen to that honky-tonk music, and you can dance with the girls, and you can sell them used cars, and you can whip and jive around here, just drink Coke. Drink that Coca-Cola, you know. And somewhere somebody slipped something in that Coca-Cola or something, I don't know what happened, but Bobby Joe, he got some booze in him, and he just couldn't sober up again, and he just couldn't make it, you know, and he just died in a terrible convulsion hospital down there, tied down on a bed. Or maybe I'll tell you about another lady that's in my life in these 13 years. My wife talked about her this morning. Her name was Carlene. Carlene, she used to be so crazy. She came over to my house on Saturday, and she'd take all the dishes out of the damn shelves, and she'd put new paper on the shelves, and she'd get them dishes, and she'd wipe every one of them, put them back up in there, you know. We'd take her to meetings, and one day she decided she didn't go to meetings anymore. She decided, so the alcoholic's gone in my life. She don't have to do that. And she was nuts, and we tried to talk to her. We spent one whole morning trying to talk to her. You got to stay here till the magic happens. Don't leave 5 minutes before the magic happens. Come to the meetings. Go to the meetings. We're going to the meetings. She said, you're crazy. She said, I don't have to go to those meetings anymore. She don't have to go to those meetings anymore. She got right in her gardener's face one Saturday morning instead of putting that paper on them shelves, and the gardener stabbed her 8 times in the chest with a gardening tool, murdered her right in her front yard. A terrible death in front of the neighbors, everything. Just, she don't need to go to those meetings. She proved to me she don't have to go to those meetings. I'll tell you about another Juana. I'll tell you about Juana the Witch, man. Juana the Witch used to hang around the Lano Club, and she knew I was having a little trouble with my wife trying to be faithful, and Juana come up to me, and she said, I'll tell you what you need, Keith. You need to have somebody teach you about sex and sobriety. She said, I'll teach you about that. I said, well, you know, Juana, I love you, but I'm going to tell you something. You see, I can't be unfaithful to my wife.
and stay sober. I know that. See, because of my inventory, every time I was unfaithful to my wife, I drank before, during, and after, and I can't do it. Maybe other people can do it, and I appreciate the offer. But she said, well, I'll tell you what, you need a teacher, and I'm willing to help you. I mean, she couldn't stay sober more than about 30, 60, 90 days, but she happened to be sober when she was telling me about that. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I'd like to do it. I really would, but I'm telling you, I just can't do it and stay sober. And she made some smart remark about me being some kind of a wimp, and I went out and got in my car and drove around the club four times, knew I'd go back and open that door, and she'd be right in there in the seat, but I didn't do it. Wanda died in the Bakersfield jail. Down in the Bakersfield jail in a fit of rage, jealousy, another woman killed her because she cheated on her man. Did she prove that? She gave her life to prove that, or maybe I'll tell you about Jerome. Jerome, he was one of them hip, slick, and cool guys. And you see, he kept telling me, see, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, your wife and your kids come back. Your kid come back, you got your family. If I could just get my family, I could sober up. And he couldn't get his family because he couldn't stay sober long enough. And I'd tell Jerome, hey, man, it says in that book, wife or no wife, job or no job, sobriety must come first. And he said, but I can't do it. I got to have my family back. And he drove his car into a bridge abutment, loaded, drunk. Because he couldn't get his family. He proved that book. Or maybe Jimmy Don. Jimmy Don taught me about money. You know what he taught me about money? He put 6 balloons of heroin and 6 balloons of coke down his throat, sober. He'd make that big money. Big money. Just take a trip. Go in the bathroom, unload it. One of them balloons unloaded on him. I'm standing across the room. He was stone cold sober before that thing unloaded on him, and I watched him turn inside out. He taught me something about money. Or maybe Fred. I'll tell you about Fred. Fred's one of those guys that rage and hate. Just rage and hate. No matter what, he's 6 years sober. Rage and hate. Don't work the steps. Don't do nothing. Just don't drink. Just rage and hate. Rant and rave. No sponsor. Nothing. Just rage and hate. Rage and hate. Test you all the time. I watched him eat up with hate. I literally watched him in 6 years of sobriety. I watched the hate because he refused to wimp out. He just hate. I watched it happen. I watched him die. I watched him die in a hospital 6 years clean and sober, and nobody went to see him, really. Or maybe Jimbo, my old buddy Buzzard Jim. You know what Jim taught me? Jim taught me that there's some of us who are thoroughly incapable of being honest with ourselves. Because he knew he was a loser and he could never get a Jim died drunk. Jim died drunk. Or maybe Madeline, my stepmother. I watched her die. She carried the message to my wife. And yet she hated her God. Had a punishing God. All you could talk about was a punishing God. She never was able to just grasp that little special something, that little spark, the belief, the willingness. I don't know why she couldn't get it when somebody else can, but she could never get it. And I just watched it die. It withered and died. Or maybe my buddy, my old homie, Risto, man, I mean, the clubby, he's tough. He taught me something. He told me something. He said, Keith, you're weak. You're a wimp. You've been a wimp all your life. God, I hate to hear that. I don't want to be a wuss, man. I don't want to be that. But he told me. He spent 45 minutes telling me that I'm a wimp. That I never did have it, man, that I'm just a wimp. And I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous with a bunch of wimps. He's standing there with his letters on, that thing on his back. 5 minutes later, he's dead right in front of me. Somebody stabbed him in the heart with a knife. He proved he's tough. You see, those are 13 people that literally gave their life to prove that I'm right. To prove that I'm right. See, we stand around here and we praise everybody, praise the committee, and praise everybody, the sponsors and all that. But what about the ones that gave their life to prove that this thing works? The ones that can't get it. They just can't get it. They're so close, but they just can't get it. For every year of my sobriety, there's been somebody that was the example. Every one of those people I was intimately involved with. I spent time with them. They debated the difference. They showed me by their example that they couldn't get it. They told me that what I'm doing is wrong. And yet they gave their life a horrid, terrible death to prove that I'm right. So I have a lot of gratitude for those people. Tremendous amount of gratitude for those people. It's because of those people that I can stand here and say that, and I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. I can stand here and say that I love my wife, I've been faithful to her ever since I've been sober, and I love her more and more each day. And that little girl that lived in the house, she loves her daddy, and I love her. And you know, our house is in order, and there's, I don't give a damn. She is 26 years old. She's still my little girl, and she loves me, and she's been able to, you know, look beyond where other people have feared to go, and she's fulfilled a dream. See, that's what I live today. I live a life that's beyond my wildest drunken dream. See, I didn't know anything about those things. I had to come here, and you showed me. You know, I had it all wrong. I thought I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth all my life. I want to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. I want to hold my mud, be tough, and have that thing. I had all the toys and the costumes to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. I didn't have it. You see, I had to come here to find out who it is. You know who the meanest man on the face of the earth is today? Me. I am. I'm him. You know who he is? He's that guy who lives down the street, got a job, wife and a kid, dog and a cat. Gets up in the morning, go take a shower, shave, and puts his clothes on, clean underwear and everything, goes out and kisses his wife goodbye and walks across the room, don't have to kick the dog or the cat, and he can hug his kid and say, I love you, and he can go get in the car and drive down the street and don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off, you know. He can go to that job and work with them crap heads all day long, and he can get that stupid check, that one that, you know, $243, and you know, I made more than that stealing in 15 seconds, you know. I got this thing clocking in, clocking out in that job, but it's what I pay the bills for, and I go home and I got a beautiful home. It's full of people that love me, and I love them, and it's full of Alcoholics Anonymous and love and life and laughter, and I can lay down in the afternoon and take a nap. A speed freak take a nap's a spiritual experience. And you can show up at a place like this, and you can laugh and cry and kiss them goodbye. See, that's the whole deal. That's what it's all about. It takes guts to do that. It takes guts to do that. Any cute can go out here and get loaded. I'll look down on that, but it takes guts to stay here. Everything you got, man. It takes everything you got and then some. I'm grateful that the then some comes from rooms like this and people like you. God bless you.